Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Our friend Leonard Rogoff has a new book. It's called Gertrude Wild, Jewish Progressive in the New South, and it features a North Carolina woman. She's a Jewish activist down in Goldsboro, involved in a wide range of progressive, even leftist causes. Often back then, controversial. They don't seem quite as controversial now, but back then, women's suffrage, labor reform, and civil rights. And she lived a long time, but she's been dead a long time, Leonard Rogoff. Why did you want to write a book about a woman who's been dead for almost 50 years?
Well, when I first learned of her, I remember coming, you know, she died in 1971. But when I first learned of her, I remember coming home and telling my wife that I was in love with another woman, but she didn't have to worry that she'd been dead for 30 years. I think there are two things. I mean, first, she had this extraordinary career she's the first North Carolinian to graduate from Smith College. She was the leader and led the fight for women's suffrage in North Carolina. She founded and was the first president of the League of Women Voters, and she worked very closely with people like Frank Graham and Howard Odom on progressive causes. And then in her 80s, she threw herself into the civil rights movement. But I think what was most enticing was her character. You know, everyone said that meeting her was life-changing, you know, that she...
Could you feel that in the reports that you got? Because she's long gone. Did you ever meet her?
I never met her. But whenever I would ask people who did know her, I kind of observed it was almost a physical reaction. First, when I asked them, you know, did you know Gertrude Wild? And immediately their face would brighten into a broad smile. They would sit up. As one of her biographers or profilers described her, you know, straightforward, straight back, but never straight laced. And a lot of people always referenced her sparkling blue eyes, which kind of shone not just with curiosity and kindness, but also with a very high sense of mischief. I just saw another little profile that's written of her that described her as forever young. And she remained youthful even on her deathbed. She was looking forward.
All that's fascinating, but I mean, we have characters that we've met, particularly people who in old age remain vibrant, that we're interested in and inspired by. Mm-hmm. But why did she merit a book this far back in probably years of your effort?
Yeah, certainly. I wanted to put a gold sticker on the book, you know, 4 years in the making. I think she's been described by historians as the most prominent of North Carolina's organized women. But I certainly had the feeling that there are a lot of women in North Carolina who are deserving of biography, who had a transformative influence on the state society and politics. Women like Cornelia German, Kate Burr Johnson. I know we've had biographies now of
Gladys Tillett.
Gladys Tillett would be another one, yes. And we've had biographies of Susan Sharp and Nell Battle Lewis and so on. But certainly, you know, Gertrude Wild was the suffrage fight in North Carolina was of national consequence. 35 states had ratified, and we needed a 36th
state. I want to go. Now you got me off my little plan, but it's your book. You can go where you want to. But you keep talking about Gertrude Wild.
Yes,
and so I think her name is spelled W-E-I-L.
Yes.
I would have said Gertrude Wild.
Yeah.
Would that have been an insult to this Goldsboro family or Gertrude's family?
Well, the family retains much of her character, and I don't think they would have felt insulted.
They don't go off and get mad about stuff like
no,
that. But here's what I want to deliver to our listeners.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this conversation now and you want to take away something that you can remember forever and use it at cocktail parties.
Yeah.
And somebody says Gertrude Wild, you say, oh, no. In Goldsboro, they say wheel.
Yeah, as I said, for most of the world, another very Jewish family going back to the early Republic were originally Jewish family were the Mordecais in most of the world, and it's Mordecai
in North Carolina.
We do things differently. And the name is very, very common of wheel or vial among Alsatian French Jews and also Bavarian German Jews. In France, I guess it's this would be pronounced vial. In Germany, I guess, vial, I guess. And in most of the South, you'll hear it pronounced while. In Goldsboro, they pronounce the name wheel, which I guess was for small-town Southerners, not fluent in German, would have been the
way that – and so the family adapted to the way that the people in Goldsboro, where they moved to, how they said the name, they didn't argue about it.
Well, you know, it'd be interesting, and I've never really asked them because, like a lot of the antebellum and Jewish families in North Carolina that came down through Baltimore, and I would be wondering how the Baltimore branch of the family pronounced their name.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
I mean, I know there are, as I said, Wiles in Charlotte and in Greensboro. Who don't pronounce it wheel.
Who in a different way. But those who are listening, just remember that if you're talking about Gertrude Weil, or you better say wheel. And if you're talking about Goldsboro Wild, you better say wheels. And that's something, a piece of information that we've delivered that I think will be remembered, maybe even more than some of the other things we talk about. But what I'm really interested in right now, before we get to Gertrude's accomplishments, is the migration of this family from Bavaria and other parts of Germany to the United States right before the Civil War. Tell us how they got here.
Well, they were quite typically they were village Jews living on the border in Bavaria in Württemberg, and Jews in Germany were very much an oppressed minority over centuries. They were
not long before the experiences, the Holocaust and Hitler experiences.
There were special taxes in some principalities. There were laws that only the oldest son could marry. Their professions were restricted. They couldn't own land. And there'd been the failed revolutions of 1848, which had promised to, among other things, to emancipate Jews. And there was also a Jewish enlightenment led by the philosopher Moses Mendelssohn that were arguing that Jews should be judged not on the basis of their beliefs but on their conduct and were deserving of citizenship in the state. After the revolutions of 1848 failed, a slow migration of Bavarian Jews to America became much more of a flood, and the wheels were part of that migration. They came to Baltimore and—
How did they get the money to pay for a passage?
Were they
pretty well off? You could still be oppressed. You can be oppressed and still figure out
The family legend was that the Wheels came here with money, that the parents had been antique dealers. But more typically what happened was an oldest son came to America, and he worked and he saved up money and then sent the money back to bring his brothers, and the two of them worked, and you had what's to this day is still you see it among other ethnic groups is the family chain migration. And the Dean of American Jewish Historians has famously quipped that no Jew was ever the first to come to a community. He was always preceded by his uncle. and that's quite typical.
Well, I'm fascinated. I want you to tell the story of them coming to Goldsboro. And here's the framework of my wonderment about this is that they came to Goldsboro 4 or 5 years, I guess, before the Civil War, a few years before the Civil War. And they did come maybe one brother first. But almost immediately, they took control. I mean, it wasn't like they were peddlers for In the typical thing, walking around selling stuff out of the backpack, and then getting a wagon, and then only getting the store. They got the store, and they took over the banks and the economy of the town.
Well, they first came here, as I said. The original wheels to come were Gertrude's two aunts, which is unusual that the daughters came, and one of them became engaged to a Baltimore peddler, Henry Ettinger. Ettingers are still a prominent North Carolina family, and Henry Ettinger was peddling in eastern North Carolina, and he opened a Goldsboro store and sent for his brother-in-law, Herman Wheel.
Ettinger first in Goldsboro.
Well, and then also on Gertrude's maternal side, the Rosenthals, her grandfather had come, I think, probably as early as the 1840s or early 1850s. He had moved from Raleigh. Emil Rosenthal. And then he had settled in Wilson, and he had a store. And they were very hardworking, and they were industrious. And Gertrude's uncle had joined the Confederate Army, so her father was brought from Baltimore to work
the
store.
She was eligible, as you point out in your book, to be a member of the Daughters of the Confederacy, but she never joined.
Yeah, she had another uncle who was actually killed at Seven Pines, and her grandfather, Emil Rosenthal, had been a Confederate agent. But comically enough, when she received an honorary degree from Women's College, they said it would be easier to list the organizations that she was not a member of than those that she was. And the United Daughters of the Confederacy was probably the only organization she did not join.
I mean, you're the historian of Jewish North Carolina, but was this typical that these Jews who were oppressed in Europe got to the United States and momentarily became the leading citizens of a community?
It was very typical. First it was their economic integration. As I said, they were hardworking. Typically what happened was they started out, that evolution that you talked about from peddling to opening a store. And then they would maybe speculate in cotton. They would send cotton north. And again, there were relationships of family and business that overlap because,
So these Jews who came down from Baltimore were connected through Baltimore throughout the whole East Coast in a way that Southerners who are trying to make it in the retail business or in some other way, they were having to use their own resources without the help that might come.
They had their own sources of capital and their own commercial network. I mean, an even more outstanding example would be the Cohn family of Greensboro. Their father had a wholesale import-export business in Baltimore, and he sent his two sons, Moses and Caesar, down to sell merchandise. They would sell to mill stores, then send the fabric, buy fabric, send it north. And then they began investing in mills and were successful. And then they began building mills. And they created this cone mill empire in Greensboro.
Well, is it fair? We're more familiar with the cones, I guess, than the wheels. Cones in Greensboro and the wheels in Goldsboro. Is it fair to say, though, that the wheels were sort of the a mini version of the cones in Goldsboro?
Well, I think,
would you say they surpassed the?
Well, I mean, the cone mills, the wheels were earlier, and I guess that primarily their fortune was founded not on they invested in industry, but it was more so they were invested in land holdings and banking and retail merchandising and warehousing. So they're probably not didn't have the kind of cachet that a manufacturer like the Cones did. But again, they were all kind of family enterprises, that involved brothers and cousins.
I don't want to stop talking about this, but we've got to take a break for time.
Sure.
If you join us late, I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff, and we're talking about the Wheel family, mainly because Leonard has written a new biography of Gertrude Wheel, a very prominent and famous North Carolinian who we'll be talking about after we finish talking about her family. And Leonard and I will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff, who is the author of a new biography of Gertrude Wheel. It's Wheel and not Weil. And the subtitle is Jewish Progressive in the New South. Leonard, we've been talking, and I want to talk for just a moment more about her background and her family, because the Wheel family is an incredibly important and interesting North Carolina family. Before we took the break, we were talking about the Confederate service of her uncle, two of her uncles, I guess.
Yeah.
And these were recent immigrants to America. And had nothing to do with slavery.
Right.
And yet they joined the Confederate Army. It flies in the face of what has become accepted history, that this war was all about slavery and that everybody fought for it was fighting for slavery.
Yeah.
These people weren't fighting for slavery. They were fighting for their neighbors or because our guests. Or
yeah.
Were they fighting for slavery?
No, I don't think they certainly were not slaveholding. I mean, they were recent immigrants, and the Rosenthal side of her family, to the very modern day, seems to have had a great deal of sympathy after for African Americans, even after the 1898 race riots. Her mother was very, very upset and wrote about how could, you know, African Americans ever have good feeling towards white people again in terms of what was done to them. And that was quite unusual for the time. I can't say her father was as equally sympathetic, but I can't find I think for a lot of these German Jews, and we do have a diary of a Tar Heel Confederate written by a Jewish soldier, sharpshooter, from Charlotte, and he does express racist feelings, but again, and we have some writings from a Jewish soldier who went to the Hillsborough Military Academy and was killed in a North Carolina regiment, who did come from a slaveholding family. But mostly what they talk about is defending their homeland from invasion, and most of them joined the Confederate forces after Lincoln had called for 75,000 recruits. And I think what they had behind them were memories of the 1848 German revolutions when the German states were trying to establish their independence upon Republican grounds, and the Prussian Empire invaded and stifled all that and returned Jews who had hopes of emancipation returned them to their medieval
status.
So, I mean,
you're suggesting that it's an analogy that might have worked for them to think that the Union forces were like Prussian forces.
Yeah, that they refer to that tyrant. Abraham Lincoln is what they write.
That's interesting.
But there is not any mention at all that I can find in their writings of a defense.
Well, Leonard
Rogoff,
I'd talk to you all afternoon about the background and the Civil War connective links. But let's move to Gertrude and tell us about Gertrude was born near enough to the Civil War to be impacted by it, but she was.
Oh yeah,
but tell us about her.
Yeah, I mean, they put a dress and a sash on her for the dedication of the Bentonville Confederate Monument when Wade Hampton came to town. But she had no interest in lost cause nostalgia. She was born in Goldsboro in 1879 and would die there in 1971 in the very house, if not the very room, in which she was born. And all of her life, she remained a citizen of Goldsboro, dedicated to the school system, to public health, a judge of the flower show. But she was also a citizen of the world.
Tell us about her growing up and what Goldsboro was like. It was a more vibrant city or town back then, maybe, than we think of it now. But tell us about how did she grow up?
Well, it was a typical of the mill and market towns that sprouted along railroad lines across the new South. It had the good fortune to be the junction of the north-south, the Wilmington to Weldon Railroad, which was at the time the longest railroad in the world, and then in the mid-1850s of the North Carolina Railroad, which was the terminus from Goldsboro to Charlotte. So it developed as a commercial hub. Shortly, you know, which was about the time that the wheels had arrived in the town, and again, you know, this was great social transformations as industry arose. Poor people were drawn from the countryside to work in the mills, and there was just, you know, terrible poverty, and the wheel women threw themselves into every social welfare cause. They were founders and leaders of the women's club, the local women's club, of the Ladies Benevolence Society, which took responsibility for the town's poor. Gertrude's aunt was co-chair of the drive to build a hospital, and when the school system was on the verge of bankruptcy, her uncle stepped forward and said, you know, I will pay any money to keep the schools open. So they were very generous involved. But Gertrude was, after going through the Goldsboro Public Schools, went off to Horace Mann.
Ask you this. She is, for anybody who joined us, like Gertrude Wheel, living in Goldsboro, the child of Jewish German immigrants. Her father was born in Germany.
Yeah, Bavaria.
And in Bavaria, and so, but he came and became a leader in the community in Goldsboro. Could he? I mean, where did he learn English, and how did he speak with a strong accent, and how did all that work?
Well,
this foreigner comes in.
I never had the good fortune to hear him speak, but I've seen his letters, and they're entirely fluent in English. I mean, he arrived here as a teenager, and you know, they're even eloquently written. And but he was certainly multicultural. You know, when you ask him who his favorite composers were, he would say Mozart, and then mention Hart and Hartigan, who wrote what was then Broadway musicals, and the same thing. His favorite poets were Schiller, and then he named some forgotten. I think Joseph Sachs, his name was, some American satirical poet. So, you know, they had barbecue and goose cracklings, you know, on the table. So they certainly acculturated. And don't forget, at the South, at this time, welcomed immigration, especially white immigration. I mean, there was even an immigration society in eastern North Carolina to try to bring white immigrants.
So even if you're Jewish,
yes,
we might be a little prejudiced against you, but not much. If you're white, you...
Yeah, you can look at the Dunn credit reports, and there is always suspicion of Jews. I mean, one, they're foreigners, the Northerners, they're not Christian. On the other hand, the Wheel extended family, including the Rosenthals and the Ettingers, are always spoken up very highly as people of, I think, strict integrity, praised for their hard work, for their energy.
These are in their credit reports.
Yeah, these are in the – and it was usually local bankers, lawyers, and so on who made this report. So you're getting a reflection of community opinion. And they're always spoken of as – and they were – again, this was after the Civil War, and the society is trying to – redeem and rebuild itself after this devastation, and it's making the transition in from an agricultural to an industrial society. I mean, and there are other communities where peddlers arrive in a town, and a local businessman will say, I will set up a store and give you credit if you will open a store. We need a store in Troy or Fair Oaks or wherever it is. You know, they wanted this commerce. And they needed people to provide these services. So they were, in many ways, representative men and women of the New South.
I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff about his new biography of Gertrude Wheel, yeah, a Jewish progressive in the New South. And I'm so interested in the background of the Wheel family that I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll really talk about Gertrude.
Okay.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you join us late, I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff, who is the author of a new biography of Gertrude Wheel. And Leonard, you've told us about enough about her family background for us to know that it was rich and diverse and complicated and a real another look at North Carolina history. But tell us about Gertrude and her education, that, as it might have differed from that of other young Southern women in the upper class, Southern women.
Well, she went through the public school system just as government was taking responsibility for education, and her father served on the school board, and the chair of the school board was Charles Brantley Aycock.
Don't get me started. But, I mean, okay. This is a right. But yeah, I want to go there. But
our education Aycock. Governor, yeah. And so again, she had a progressive education, and actually, the school system was based on German models, the public school reform movement. And then her parents sent her off to Horace Mann School, newly established at Columbia University.
Now, was this a college or was this a continuation of her high school education?
Well, the continuation of her high school education. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, it was an integrated school. The children of Charles Chestnut, an African-American author from North Carolina, were also students there. And then she went and became the first North Carolinian to graduate from Smith College. And she graduated just at the time that Smith was evolving its curriculum from the classical canon, Greek and Latin and literature and language and so on, into modern subjects like sociology, economics, psychology. So she became not only – she was always a Southern lady, very polite, deferential, modest, to the point of self-abasement. But she became also a new woman, progressive, independent, forward-looking. And she faced the dilemma that many college women college graduates at the time confronted, which was she'd been educated, but for what? You know, professions had not yet opened for them. The idea of a woman pursuing a career outside the home wasn't quite accepted. And her mother drew her back home. To work in – she had established a kind of daycare center in a mill village for the children of mill workers, and that was her start in social welfare work.
And then where did – you know, that seems to be a very modest beginning for a young woman, intelligent, bright, with great resources, who's been trained at one of the best women's colleges in the world, really.
Right.
And she comes back and goes to work in a daycare center?
Yeah, teaching sewing to the girls. And that was a dilemma faced by many women of her time. Her mother had presided at the formation of a women's club in Goldsboro in 1898. And Gertrude joined and earned the sobriquet of Federation Gertie. She actually refused the state presidency when it was offered to her.
Of what organization?
The Federation of Women's mm-hmm. Clubs, which mm-hmm. was a national organization and was the platform for many women. And she was always pressing this organization to move beyond just become a social and literary society.
Or an action-oriented.
Yeah, a ladies' luncheon into a
Well, let's get things done.
Yeah.
And what did they want to get? What did they want to get done?
Children's labor, women working in the mills.
Well, they they weren't participating in politics. They couldn't vote. I couldn't even vote.
Well, that was the issue for her. I mean, they were arguing that women become notaries, have the right to serve in the school board. And then Gertrude, I think the reason she turned down the presidency was by this point she had her eyes on the prize of women's suffrage. And they realized that progressive social welfare reform would not take place until and unless
women had the vote. What time period are we talking about now?
We're talking between the era before World War I. And World War I kind of delays the momentum.
Well, there is a story in her efforts to achieve suffrage in North Carolina, but it's kind of complicated. What did she do?
Well, North Carolina was not exactly a cauldron of suffrage activism. An early bill on women's suffrage, the legislature referred to the Committee on Insane Asylums, which was typical. I mean, North Carolina was being its usual laggard self. And not even her mother and her aunt, who were progressive women, really at that point endorsed suffrage. In 1913, she joined this a women's suffrage association formed in North Carolina, and she joined and founded a league in Goldsboro. And by 1919, she was its president.
This was, for me, shocking to learn from your book that there were many, many women, maybe the majority of women, who opposed suffrage.
Yes.
And you introduced the notion that part of that had a racial background.
And oh, yes.
How did that work?
Well, there were fears that opening suffrage, granting women suffrage, would open the whole question of franchise. Opening, for one thing, it would give women the right to vote. Black mm-hmm. women the right to vote.
Well, it would give them the right to vote if they could pass the literacy test.
The literacy test, but again, and even the League of Women Voters supported literacy tests, for example, mm-hmm. Supposedly fairly administered. But Gertrude was put on in a dilemma because to oppose white supremacy in the South at this time would have been political suicide, would have killed any possibility of the women's vote. On the other hand, she never engaged in race baiting. You don't find any kind of the racial disparagement that you find even in prominent Southern liberals like the Chief Justice of the Walter Clark, for example, who were also – or Charles Aycock, for that matter. He was a progressive except on this yeah. whole racial issue.
Well, let me – again, I apologize. I told you I would interrupt you, and I'm – basically doing that, but this is education that you've given me from your book, that progressivism was, in those days, was totally interwoven with race.
Yeah.
And that Charles Aycock and, to a certain extent, the Wheel family said, in order to get progress, we can't have blacks voting. I mean, that was sort of, you know.
Yeah, well, Gertrude always said, I was born with prejudices. She always acknowledged that in herself. And in the 1920s, the family, you could be a kind of a principled segregationist, and some people make this point about Aycock, and support black uplift.
Yes.
Within the limits of a segregated society. Dr. James Shepherd, who, you know, became the founding president of what is now North Carolina Central University, used that very, very cleverly, that separate but equal means that you have to support my black institution. And he won, you know, governmental and philanthropic support for his institution on that basis. But by the 1930s, she had joined the Association of Southern White Women for the Prevention of Lynching. A year later, she was governor appointed to the Committee on Interracial Cooperation. But by the 1940s, she worked very closely with black women on educational issues and on public health issues.
Let's take a break and then come back and concentrate totally on her work on civil rights and other liberal causes as she grew older. If you joined us late, I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff. We're talking about his new biography of Gertrude Wheel, Jewish Progressive in the New South, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Leonard Rogoff, and the center of our attention is on Gertrude Wheel, who is the subject of his new biography of this important woman who lived in a very interesting age.
Yeah.
And Leonard, I forgive myself for leading you off track because it is a history of our time. But let's spend the last few minutes that we got together just telling me what she did in the middle and ending part of her life that merited your writing her biography.
Yeah, well, as I mentioned, she was involved in all the social welfare causes, primarily working women, working children, public health. She always said, you know, that her chief interest in life was social welfare. And she grew increasingly aware that the social welfare problems of the South and the deprivation and poverty could not be resolved until the racial situation was addressed. And she had originally taken the position, I think, of that was common among Southern liberals, including Frank Graham, which was gradualism, that first we had to change hearts and minds and prepare the ground before we could have integration. And it was just these gradualists that I think Dr. Martin Luther King addressed his letter from a Birmingham jail. That letter was not addressed to segregationists. It was addressed to moderates who believed Birmingham had just thrown out its segregationist government and was bringing in racial moderates who believed in gradual integration. And Dr. King said, no, direct action now. And she came over to that position. And she worked through when the Southern Regional Council, of which she was a member, voted in the late 1940s to support integration. Half its white members left, but Gertrude did not. And then when the civil rights movement exploded in Goldsboro, they created a biracial council in which her nephew Henry took a very, very active role. Gertrude would have already have been in her 80s. But she was on the executive committee of the steering committee for the biracial council, the women's steering committee. And she opened her home for a parlor meeting for black women and white women to get together and have coffee and eat donuts. And I read the testimony of one black woman and said that was the point where integration, when we went into each other's homes, again, you know, as equals through the front door. But the stories that are told of her, and again, I think what's always enticing about her is her character, even more so than, you know, the list of organizations that she headed. But
was she a saint?
God, you put a halo on her. I'm sure she would have, if she found out that I was writing a biography, she would have told me I was a damn fool and would have not had anything of it. She had a very sharp tongue, was frank-spoken, and she would never, ever describe herself. She was very, very self-effacing and modest, and she described herself
Why
as,
didn't quote, she get married?
I think she used to joke that the only people she could have married were her brother Leslie and Frank Graham.
There was, in your book, you say there was a little rumor of, or a little something going on in the way of a courtship. Kind of.
I don't know if it was a courtship, but they were both there's plenty of correspondence between them. And Graham was an intimate friend of the Wheel family, including her brother Leslie, would grow all teary-eyed when Frank Graham recalled Leslie, and delivered a tribute to her at a testimonial dinner, and it took Graham 7 pages to do so. But they were both so much alike. They were both kindly, short, athletic.
But iron-willed in terms of their goodness, I guess, or their determination to improve society.
Yeah. As I say, the two of them were not just respected but also loved. And even, everybody's startled to hear Jesse Helms speak so well of Frank Graham. And even Gertrude's enemies, you know, there was a kindliness in her demeanor. She had a very quick laugh, as I said, she's been described by another biographer as, quote, forever young, very youthful disposition and manner and kind-hearted, generous. The charities of the family, the extended family, and they were all done quietly and privately.
What are the lessons? We've got a minute.
Yeah.
What are the lessons? What are the lessons from her life that for you and for me and for others who will be reading your book?
Well, I think one thing that's especially relevant for North Carolina was that she always remained a very traditional Southern lady. She was religious. You'd find her every Sunday. Not Sunday, I should say, Friday nights, attending services at her temple. She was a spiritual woman, a religious woman, Sunday school teacher for over 50 years. But she also held progressive values. I mean, everybody's talking about the contradictions and paradoxes and conflicts of North Carolina. And she was a citizen of Goldsboro and a citizen of the world. She was a provincial. She was a cosmopolitan. And all these contradictions existed in a very happy harmony within her. And I think, you know, she always said her ambition in life was to live her ideals. And politics now has become very cynical, where celebrity is sort of the pathway to political success. And she was here. She was a woman, modest and kind-hearted and generous.
Well, so much more to talk about, Linda Rogoff. Thanks for acquainting us with the life of Gertrude Wheel, and also with the complexities of life in North Carolina during her lifetime. And I think there are lessons for us today from her life, and I appreciate your bringing it to us right now. Thanks to Linda Rogoff. Thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, Who's Talking, WCHL 97.9 The Hill. I'll be back here before you know it.